Good afternoon again. There is something that we need in the church that is often very hard to have in this world. Actually, there is many in the world that have this quality, believe it or not, many in the world who do, which needs to be found in the church. There have been many good examples. Many people have written books, historical or even in current times, of people who have this quality, this incredible quality to be able to have. I would go so far as to say that the church needs to be a place this quality should be found more than what you find in the world. It should be found here among us. It is something each of us need to grow in. The reason we need to grow in this quality is that the negativity that surrounds us day in and day out, I think all of us could say, yeah, every single day, 6 days a week, you're out somewhere else, day in and day out, has the ability to deplete this quality out of our lives, has that ability. If this quality is depleted in our lives, then we don't carry it in with us when we deal with one another. When we're not in here, we can't, if it's depleted the other 6 days and we walk in here, we don't have it. Something that we need when we do walk in here. Now, this isn't a one congregation issue. I've already given this a few times. It was not meant for any one congregation. It's for all congregations. It's for all people. I believe we will have to work harder as the pressures of society put more demand, more pressure, and stress on our individual lives. And I do think as time goes on, society around us will put on more pressure, more weight, more. It'll make it harder. As you're looking around, you can see things changing, things that weren't there 20 years ago, things that weren't there 10 years ago, things that weren't there 5 years ago, and they're here now, and it's more pressure, it's harder, it's heavier. I also believe that our surroundings may be depleted or depleting when we are, in fact, supposed to be increasing. Look at Jesus Christ's example. I love thinking about his example. Because when life got so hard for him, it was so difficult, things were really, really bad, he was better and stronger. His light was shining even more, and it's a quality that we are to try to emulate, something that we need. As time out there gets harder, our lights shine even brighter. We want that quality within us. The environment of the congregation and the environment of the church is to foster this quality. We're to learn it when we're here. Build it. Also know that some people, some members, naturally have this quality in abundance. I've known people, and it just comes out of it. It's a beautiful gift when somebody has this quality, and it comes out of them, and it's such a gift to everyone else. And then there's some of us that it needs work. We need to work at it, but it's still a quality that we need. I'd like to look at a story to begin exploring this quality. It doesn't have a title. This story didn't have a title. And it's also from an unknown author. We don't know that. We got this from inspirationalstories.eu. Starts off this way. It says, two men were seriously ill. They occupied the same room in the hospital. One of them was lying in the bed near the only window in the room. Every day, he was allowed to spend some time sitting up in his bed to help draining the fluid from his lungs. The other man was forced to spend all his days flat on his back, both of them in a bad situation. They talked a lot about their life, their families, their jobs, their vacations. Every time when the first man was sitting by the window, he described in detail all that he saw outside the window. His roommate always looked for those moments. It was something he looked forward to when his world was broadened and brightened up by the world outside. Amazing views of a park with a beautiful lake could be seen from the window of their room. Children delightfully played among ducks and swans. Couples walked arm in arm among colorful flowers. Also, the stunning city skyline could be seen. When the man by the window had been thoroughly describing all that was happening outside the window, his roommate, the one flat on his back, would close his eyes and imagine all the beautiful scenes of life that were told to him. One night, the man whose bed was near the window died peacefully during sleep, and his roommate was very sad. After some time, when the nurse came to visit him, he asked if he could be moved next to the window. The nurse agreed and kindly made the switch. When she left, the man slowly and painfully propped himself up on one elbow. and took the first look at the world outside. He was stunned. The window faced a blank wall. When their nurse came to visit him the next time, he told her about the beautiful things outside the window that his roommate described to him. The nurse replied, "Sir, your roommate was blind." She said, "Probably he just tried to encourage you." See, I knew that this was a story that would have a lesson of encouragement because that's what I was looking for, a lesson for encouragement, the quality that we need. When I started to read the story, it was apparent that the roommate was encouraging a very sick person by becoming his eyes. He was doing something really good. What he didn't see, the roommate would describe. It became an escape from just looking at the ceiling above. I've never met anybody in my life who said, "I like my time in the hospital. I like being in that room for a long period of time." It was his escape. But it became more than that. This man was an encourager. It's a beautiful thing, what he was able to do. He described a beautiful picture of what was in his mind, and he shared it. He changed the whole environment of the hospital room. Something else I liked about this story, it wasn't so grand. It wasn't this massive story that took place. He didn't go around and change the whole environment of the hospital. He didn't change every environment of every patient in the hospital. It wasn't that at all. He was an encourager to one. I only bring that out because a good act can be to help one person as it can be to many. To change somebody's life, just one person, is an amazing act. It's a great thing to do. I'd like to turn to a passage in the Bible where someone was given a title by the other disciples. It was evident enough to be a description of who he was. It was a descriptor, this great title. It's about the Apostle Yosef. The Apostle Yosef. Let's go to Acts. Now, I paused for a minute, obviously. No one knows the Apostle Yosef. We don't typically know him as that. Acts 4, verse 36. Acts 4, verse 36. Acts 4, verse 36 says, "And Yosef, who was also named Barnabas." That's how we know him. Barnabas by the apostles, which is translated son of encouragement, a Levite of the country of Cyprus. Yosef is also translated as Yosef, or we would say Joseph. In this verse, he is not known as the apostle. That doesn't come until chapter 14 when Paul and him are sent out. And by definition of what an apostle is, they were sent out with authority and with a message. They were apostles. Not at this time that we're talking about. But here, Yosef was given the name by the apostles, which meant son of encouragement. I love that. Absolutely love that. Son of encouragement. The name Barnabas was a good, very good title if somebody was using a gift that he had. But it was more than just that he went down around and just told people nice things about themselves and he encouraged everybody. It wasn't that. That wasn't what he was trying to do. It's more than that. The actual translation is Bar, son of, Nabas, prophecy. And the most literal translation, it is son of prophecy. Son of prophecy. Meaning that he was most likely a gifted teacher and preacher. And you can see that through Acts. If you go through Acts and you're looking at different stories with him, that he's in it, you can see that. He is oftentimes the prominent speaker. He has that gift. His name, in another literal sense, means son of exhortation. But it is by that exhortation that he's an encourager. That title, son of encouragement. The message that he brought was one of encouragement. His message was that of God the Father. It was of Jesus Christ, what Jesus Christ did for mankind, who he was, where he was, and the future fulfillment of God's whole plan. It is the greatest message of encouragement that we could ever hear. And that was what flowed through him. His gifted role was to bring the most exciting news about the Messiah, the Anointed One, the Prophet, our Savior. Barnabas was all in. That was his life. He was completely in. He had an ability to bring the message where it inspired and gave hope and courage for what was ahead. It's a beautiful thing. Roy T. Bennett, author and lawyer, said this. Said, "Be an encourager. When you encourage others, you boost their self-esteem, enhance their self-confidence, make them work harder, lift their spirits, and make them successful in their endeavors. Encouragement goes straight to the heart and is always available. Be an encourager always. I like that quote. Well, what is the meaning of encourage? Pretty sure we know what encourage is, but what is the meaning? Has three of them. One, to inspire with courage, confidence, or hope. To inspire with courage, confidence, or hope. Two, to give support or foster. And the third one, to stimulate or spur. You can see the value in all three. Encourage, whether we realize it or not, is an extremely valuable quality for someone else to use in your life. We all need encouragement, every single one of us. I've never met a person that doesn't need encouragement. We all need it. We need encouragement. We need encouragement as we walk this road together. Well, what is encouragement not to be? As someone told me, a bad example is a good example of what not to be. So what is encouragement not to be? Let's go to Psalm 64. Psalm 64. Here, David shows something about the wrong side of encouragement. Psalm 64. Psalm 64. We'll bring it up in verse 1. Psalm 64, verse 1. Says, hear my voice, O God, in my meditation. Note that, meditation. Preserve my life from fear of the enemy. And I think this word meditation in the New King James lessens the feeling. It's not a bad translation. It's not a wrong translation. But it lessens the feeling, the umph behind it. King James Version has prayer, which it is a prayer. It's a song, but it's a prayer. But it also doesn't quite capture it. Other translations use the word complaint. All in all, this is a prayer, but with emotion behind it. There's strain behind it. There's a lot of emotion. Brownsdriver and Briggs Lexicon list this as appropriate complaint. There was stress behind this prayer. It was a complaint. There was a lot behind it. Verse 2 says, hide me from the secret plots of the wicked, from the rebellion of the workers of iniquity. And now we're going to go in where we see the power of words. Because obviously encouragement is going to have words with it, but you can also see the power of words when it's not used correctly. Verse 3, who sharpen their tongue like a sword and bend their bows to shoot their arrows. Well, what are their arrows? Bitter words. That they may shoot in secret at the blameless. Suddenly they shoot at him and do not fear. Great description, imagery for the cutting and harmful strength of words, how they can puncture, they can cut. They can cut right through you. You know, sticks and stones may break my bones. Words never hurt me. It's false. Words cut very deeply. Our words matter. Our words matter a lot. Verse 5. They, and here's this wrong example, they encourage themselves in an evil matter. They are encouraged to do this evil. They are persuaded, inspired to do this evil. They are moved with these thoughts and these words to do it. Wrong kind of encouragement. Let's read that again. They encourage themselves in an evil matter. They talk of laying snares secretly. They say, well, who can see them? They devise iniquities. We have perfected a shrewd scheme. Both the inward thought and the heart of man are deep. Encouragement must be on the right side of things. David felt the enemy's encouragement towards each other, but against him. He felt that weight. It weighted him down. Now, we just saw here that in Psalms, that encouragement can be used in a wrong way for evil. Encouragement to do evil. Let's look at another example where encouragement must be done in truth. It has to be truthful. Let's go to 1 Kings 22. 1 Kings 22 is a story about Ahab, King Ahab and King Jehoshaphat, and a prophet. 1 Kings 22. We'll start in verse 1. 1 Kings 22, starting in verse 1, says, now 3 years passed without war between Syria and Israel. Then it came to pass in the third year that Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, went down to visit the king of Israel. And the king of Israel said to his servants, do you know that Ramoth in Gilead is ours, but we hesitate to take it out of the hand of the king of Syria? So he said to Jehoshaphat, will you go with me to fight at Ramoth Gilead? Jehoshaphat said to the king of Israel, I am as you are, my people as your people, my horses as your horses. Simply meaning, I will fight alongside of you. In his mind, it was strengthening allies, strengthening alliances. There was still a brotherhood that they would recognize. It was still Israel and Judah. There was still a history to them. Later, he was rebuked by God for helping the wicked, for helping Ahab. This is something he shouldn't have done. Verse 5, also Jehoshaphat said to the king of Israel, please inquire of the word of the Lord today. So he says, yes, Ahab, I will fight alongside of you. I will be with you, but there's a caveat. There's a caveat to me doing this. Jehoshaphat wants God's will on this matter. Again, Jehoshaphat is a good king. His life was as a good king. Made mistakes, obviously, but he was a good king. Verse 6 says, then the king of Israel gathered the prophets together, about 400 men, and said to them, shall I go against Ramoth Gilead to fight, or shall I refrain? So they said, go up, for the Lord will deliver it into the hand of the king. Probably doesn't need to be explained that this is not prophets of God. These would most likely be prophets of Baal. This is already after Elijah and the prophets of Baal and the fire came down from heaven and all that happened. And here we have another 400. These are more likely, again, prophets of Baal. The message Ahab received from them in unison is, go and God will give you victory. Go ahead and do it. It's yours. It's as good as yours. What is interesting, and another proof that these are not God's prophets, is Jehoshaphat's reluctance to take those 400 prophets' word on the matter. In verse 7, and Jehoshaphat said, is there not still a prophet of the Lord here that we may inquire of him? Another way of saying, is there not a prophet of the true God, of the eternal God that is here? Verse 8, so the king of Israel said to Jehoshaphat, there is still one man, Micaiah, the son of Imlah, by whom we may inquire of the Lord, the eternal, the self-existent, but I hate him. Ahab's a spoiled brat. Remember the whole situation with the vineyard. And he said, I want the vineyard. And he goes down and asks for the vineyard that's close to where he was. And the guy says, no, I will not have my vineyard. I won't have anything to hand down. And so he goes and he throws a fit. Jezebel comes in and says, hey, what's going on? Why are you throwing a fit? And he says, I want the vineyard and he won't give me the vineyard. So she has the man killed. He gets his vineyard and he's happy. And that's what's going on here as well. He says, I hate him because he does not prophesy good concerning me, but evil. And Jehoshaphat said, let not the king say such things. It's an interesting side note. It gives you a little bit of an insight of how people thought of God, as well as the gods, lowercase g, gods. If they prophesied good things, then it almost binds the gods to do it. If 400 prophets prophesy good things, it almost binds them to do it. You're almost forcing God's hand to give the blessings. So let's get rid of the guy who speaks truth because he doesn't like the message. I don't like how he speaks. I don't like how he speaks about me. Ahab insinuates here that Micaiah puts his own feelings in the prophetic message. You know, he hates me too, and he just makes every prophecy about me wrong. And I hate that guy. Verse 9, then the king of Israel called an officer and said, bring Micaiah the son of Imlah quickly. The king of Israel and Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, having put on their robes, sat each at his throne at the threshing floor at the entrance of the gate of Samaria. And all the prophets prophesied before them. Now Zedekiah, the son of Chenaanah, had made horns of iron for himself. And he said, thus says the Lord, with these you shall gore the Syrians until they are destroyed. So he makes this whole kind of play, this whole thing that he's doing of what will happen. Verse 12. And all the prophets prophesied so, saying, go up to Ramoth-Gilead and prosper, for the Lord will deliver it into the king's hand. Ahab at this point is eating it up. He is hearing what he wants to hear. It's exactly what he wants. But it's at this point that shows what encouragement is not to be. This is where we pick this up. Verse 13. Then the messenger who had gone to call Micaiah spoke to him, saying, now listen, We know your reputation. Now listen. The words of the prophets with one accord encourage the king. They're encouraging to him. Please let your word be like the word of one of them and speak encouragement. Can you just do it this one time? In other words, can you do that? So many things wrong with this. This is not encouragement. This is a lie. To speak encouragement to someone who is doing something wrong or something you don't agree with or is problematic is not appropriate. Not something that we would want to do. Yes, people can and will make their own decisions, but that does not mean that they deserve our encouragement if what they are doing is wrong. So Micaiah is being told, be like the other prophets and say what they're saying. Could you just follow suit? There's 400 of them. Do what they're doing. Verse 14. Micaiah said, and I love his answer, as the Lord lives, whatever the Lord says to me, that I will speak. Verse 15. Then he came to the king, and the king said to him, Micaiah, shall we go to war against Ramoth-Gilead, or shall we refrain? And he answered him, go and prosper, for the Lord will deliver it into the hand of the king. Now, it's very obvious here that Micaiah is dripping with sarcasm. Obviously, it's very easy to tell this is not his answer at all. Barnes says this. It says, Micaiah speaks the exact words of the 400 in so mocking and ironical a tone that the king cannot mistake it, his meaning, or regard his answer as serious. He gets irate. He gets angry. Verse 16. So the king said to him, how many times shall I make you swear that you tell me nothing but the truth in the name of the Lord? Ahab and Micaiah obviously are well acquainted with one another. Obviously, one hates the other. More or less, I hear Ahab saying, tell me what I want to hear and in the way that I want to hear it. Don't differ. Don't change. Just tell me what I want to hear and how I want to hear it. So Micaiah goes on from this point to describe to them two visions. The rest of it we could read over, but it basically sums up into two visions. One, a vision of scattered sheep with no shepherd, meaning, Ahab, you're going to die. This is not going to end well for you at all. And two, the heavenly scene and the lying spirits that are put into the mouths of the prophets. Obviously, this message doesn't go over well. Go down to verse 26. It says, so king of Israel said, take Micaiah and return him to Ammon, governor of the city, and Joash, the king's son. And say, thus says the king, put this fellow in prison and feed him with the bread of affliction and water of affliction until I come in peace. But Micaiah said, again, I like his message, if you ever return in peace, the Lord has not spoken by me. And he said, take heed, all you people. Well, Micaiah is only proven to be the true prophet of God. Ahab does die in the battle. That's a great lesson that encouragement is not encouragement when it's not done in truth. It doesn't fit. If we encourage someone as they continue down a path that isn't good, isn't the type of encouragement that we want to give. That's not how we want to use it as a people. It would have been easier for Micaiah just to say, go and be triumphant. He wouldn't have had the bread of affliction, the water of affliction. He wouldn't have been put in prison if he would have just said those simple words. But he couldn't do that. He had to be truthful. When looking at encouragement, there are two types of encouragement that we are to give, that each of us are to give. We find these in the definition of encouragement, but we also find them in the passages of the Bible, within the Bible. You get to find these out more. You could have 10, 15, 20 points if you wanted to of all the different ways that we can encourage, but I believe these encompass the meaning. So these are two types of encouragement. So 2 points from this point. Point one, the encouragement that we are to offer are by the words that we speak. Point one is by the words that we speak. This is an interesting one. As we've already covered, encouragement needs to be truthful. It has to be truthful. Our words need to be right. They need to be honest. They need to be helpful. Again, not a lie to make someone feel good. You know, go to battle at Ramoth-Gilead. You'll be fine. Nothing's going to happen. It's all yours. When in fact, you know it won't be. But believe it or not, your words matter for everyone else in this room. They're important for everyone else in this room. Let me also emphasize, though, encouragement is not to be something overdone, but again, honest. You don't want to have empty encouragement. You want it to be something behind it. Our encouragement must be real. Let's go to Deuteronomy 31. I'm hitting well-known stories today. Actually, stories you can get various lessons from, not just this. Deuteronomy 31. And again, we'll begin at the beginning of the chapter, verse 1. Deuteronomy 31, verse 1. Deuteronomy 31 and verse 1 says, "Then Moses went and spoke these words to all Israel." Something to note here is Moses is speaking to all Israel. It's the whole camp of Israel. His words to all Israel are verses 2 through 6. It's broken up. This 1 to 8 is broken up into two different speeches. Verse 2, "And he said to them, 'I am 120 years old today. I can no longer go out and come in. Also, the Lord has said to me, you shall not cross over this Jordan.'" So here Moses gives two reasons that his time to lead has come to an end. It's done. It's coming to an end. One, he has aged to the point of aging out of leading. He needs to step aside. And two, God said that his journey ends here, not able to cross the Jordan to the promised land. Two reasons his time stops. But because of that, obviously, there's a change that needs to happen. There's a change coming. Verse 3, some important words here that we need to hear for our own lives as well. Verse 3, "The Lord your God himself crosses over before you." He starts this off with the most important message that they could hear. I would say it's the most important message that we could hear. That God is going with you. God is going before you. The most powerful thing that they have is going with them. He's saying, "I'm not going with you, but God is." Again, the most important thing is still going with you as you cross over into the promised land. That's a message to us as well. Verse 3, all of it. Verse 3, "The Lord your God himself crosses over before you. He will destroy these nations from before you, and you shall dispossess them." Now here's a second message to verse 3. Joshua himself crosses over before you, just as the Lord has said. Leadership is being handed down. So he's saying the most important thing, God, is still going to be with you. He's still crossing over. Along with that, your new leader will be crossing over as well. A change is happening. Verse 4. "And the Lord will do to them as he did to Sihon and Og, the kings of the Amorites in their land, when he destroyed them. The Lord will give them over to you, that you may do to them according to every commandment which I have commanded you." You have your responsibility to play, they're telling Israel. You have your responsibility to play. Success wasn't only built on because they had the all-powerful, eternal God with them. That would obviously be successful, but they had their part to play. Their obedience mattered. We know that because when their obedience to God waned, they suffered. We see that throughout the history of Israel. Verse 6. Here's a strong message. We usually attribute this to Joshua. We have these things that we put on our refrigerators and all of this, but it was given to Joshua from Moses and continued several times throughout Scripture. Verse 6. "Be strong and of good courage. Do not fear nor be afraid of them. For the Lord your God, he is the one who goes with you. He will not leave you nor forsake you." This has so many valuable pieces to it. Again, these were words from Moses to all Israel. His words were powerful to move a nation of people. What was he doing? He was encouraging them, lifting them to move a nation. He says, "Be strong and of good courage. You have a journey in front of you, and like anything that you've done to this point," you could say anything behind you was also anything you've done to this point. You've never done that before, and look where you are now. But he's saying you have a journey in front of you, and like anything you've done, it'll take strength and it'll take courage to be able to do what you're going to do. Two things that you have to have. The language he is using isn't saying that they don't have the strength or courage. He's not saying, you know what, you need to go find that. Because the road you're on is very difficult, and if you don't have strength and courage, you're in trouble. His language isn't about that at all. He is saying, you already have the strength. You already have the tools. You just have to use them where you're going. Then he says, do not fear nor be afraid of them. Why does he put that in there? The two types of fear that can deplete strength and courage. How do you wipe it out? How do you erase strength and courage? By fear. Fear's how you do it. Do not fear them, meaning to desire to be like them. Don't desire to be like the kingdoms around you. You want them to desire to be like you. Be teachers. Say, don't do that. And do not be afraid of them, meaning to allow them to make you afraid. Well, what does that type of fear do? It dictates your decisions, and it's usually wrong when we let fear dictate our decisions. Well, how do you do this? He said, for, which becomes a very important word here, for the Lord your God, he is the one who goes with you. He will not leave you nor forsake you. How do you stand strong and courageous, and how do you keep fear and being afraid away from you? Knowing that the all-powerful Creator God is not only with you, which is a blessing to know. God is with you. God is in you. That is incredible. But it's the next statement attached to it that also gives you confidence and courage and all of that. He will not leave you. He doesn't just turn his back and flee. Well, why would he say that? Because the gods with the lowercase g were unreliable. All those gods that were out there, they were unreliable. They would get angry at any given time. You could never rely on those gods to do what they were going to say, because if they didn't want to, they just wouldn't, in their minds. Saying, no, you have the God that is reliable. You have the God that will walk with you. You have the God that will never leave you. He's with you, and he will never leave you. This would have been a powerful speech to move a people, move them physically, to move them emotionally, mentally, to encourage them, because this journey in front of them would be anything but easy. The next verse is directed towards Joshua, the second speech now. Verse 7 says, then Moses called Joshua and said to him in the sight of all Israel. Here are the same words. Be strong and of good courage. It wasn't only the leadership that needed to be strong. It was all of Israel that needed to be strong. Be strong and have good courage, for you must go with this people to the land which the Lord has sworn to their fathers to give them, and you shall cause them to inherit it. Again, be strong and of good courage. The leader of the people must be strong and courageous. Again, he's not saying you don't have it now and you need to go find it. He's not saying that at all. Moses is saying you have what it takes. Use it. He's moving him to action by saying, you have these qualities and you have these tools. Then in verse 8, he gives the same instruction. And the Lord, he is the one who goes before you. He will be with you. He will not leave you nor forsake you. All of that we've heard already. Do not fear nor be dismayed. The end verse, or the end phrase, is key. Do not fear nor be dismayed. Dismayed is the eraser to everything that was just previously said. Dismayed means to break down or become discouraged. To break down or become discouraged. The words of Moses were encouraging the nation, encouraging the new leader of Israel with what they needed to hear to not be discouraged. He was encouraging them. Incredible words, moving them. How can failure enter? One way, one prominent way, failure enters is by discouragement. Paul also follows this same idea. He does it several times, but it's in Corinthians I would like to go. Let's go ahead and go there. I'd like to read in 1 Corinthians. 1 Corinthians 15. Now immediately I say chapter 15 and our mind goes to a wonderful set of scriptures for end time events. 1 Corinthians 15, verse 56. 1 Corinthians 15, verse 56. Actually, let's go ahead and back up to verse 55. Verse 55 says, O death, where is your sting? O Hades, where is your victory? Verse 56, the sting of death is sin, and the strength of sin is the law. Paul just finished talking about that all at the return of Christ and the resurrection of the faithful, that the mortal will put on immortality. We look forward to this. This is stuff that excites us. We hear this every Feast of Trumpets going into this. And that Death will have no power over those who are changed. Once you're changed, death has no power. That's what he's talking about. Oh, death, where is your sting at this point? It's a glorious time to think about. At this time, sin will have no power. Listen to verse 57. But thanks be to God, who gives us the victory through our Lord Jesus Christ. Can we have more of an encouraging message than that? That victory became, or victory because Jesus is how sin no longer enslaves us. We're almost to Pentecost, but we're still not that far from Passover and the days of unleavened bread and all the messages there that he freed us. Jesus has had victory leading to the way of his followers to have victory. For them to be able to hear that at that moment was nothing but encouraging. It was lifting them. We read it. We're lifted from it. Because of that, Paul builds upon that, what we need to do. Verse 58, therefore, my beloved brethren, be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that your labor is not in vain in the Lord. He built them up. And as we read it, he builds us up. He doesn't puff us up. He builds us up. He edifies. He is encouraging the people to work, to walk, to think, to act because of that victory, that it motivates what we do. How many times do we need to hear these things? We need to hear them a lot. We need to talk about them. He is motivating them. So much so that in chapter 16, he gives a very similar message that Moses gave. A very similar one. Chapter 16, verse 13. Chapter 16, verse 13 says, watch, stand fast in the faith, be brave, be strong. Let all that you do be done with love. Again, Paul's not saying you don't have it this now. You don't have these things. He's not saying that at all. He's saying you have what it takes. And those words are written to us as well. You have what it takes to stand fast, to be brave, and to be strong. We read those as messages to our ears. He is moving them to action by saying, you have these qualities and you have these tools. The words we use have the same power to others. The words that come out of our mouths, our surroundings do enough to beat us down that when we walk in here, we want to be encouraged. Encouraged to face another week. We're here for one day a week, a few hours one day a week. We're out there 6 days a week. This needs to be an environment of encouragement, to be lifted up. If someone has a bad week, giving them encouragement to continue another week, encouraging one another to make the right decision, have the right approach, stay on the right path. The words we speak are powerful. The words we speak matter. Point number two. Very similar, but also very different. Point number two, by the support we offer. By the support we offer. There isn't one of us who doesn't need support. There's a quote by author Shannon L. Alder that says, one of the most important things that you can do on this earth is to let people know they are not alone. I like that. One of the most important things that you can do on this earth is to let people know they are not alone. Over the years, I've heard so many different times of people feeling alone. I will reread what we read in Deuteronomy 31, verse 6. We are already there. I'll just read it. It says, be strong and of good courage. Do not fear nor be afraid of them. For the Lord your God, he is one who goes with you. And it's that last statement. He will not leave you nor forsake you. The greatest encouragement we can have is to know and understand that we are never alone anyway. We are never alone. God is faithful. He is the perfect example also of what we are to strive to do. We are to strive to do the exact same thing for everyone in this room. We must be there for one another. Let's go to 1 Thessalonians. 1 Thessalonians 4. Starting in verse 9. 1 Thessalonians 4, verse 9 says, but concerning brotherly love, you have no need that I should write to you. For you yourselves are taught by God to love one another. He is talking about love, which is support, it's help, it's comfort, etc., and on and on and on. Love is a powerful thing. That quality is taught by who? Well, Paul says that quality is taught by God. It comes directly from God. It's taught by the one who will never leave us nor forsake us. But it's for us to strive to do the same. He taught us, not just so we feel it, he taught us so that we would give it. Verse 10, and indeed you do so toward all the brethren. You return it who are in all Macedonia. But we urge you, brethren, that you increase more and more. I love that verse. I love what he's telling them. They have all done well as being there for one another, for loving one another, for helping one another. Then he says that you increase more and more. In other words, well done. But as God set the bar, as God has always set the bar, we can always increase more and more. In our lifetime, we will not hit the bar, but we will improve and grow and develop and become more and more. Verse 11, that you also aspire to lead a quiet life, to mind your own business, and to work with your own hands as we have commanded you, that you may walk properly toward those who are outside, and that you may lack nothing. It's a great list of what we are to do. It says, lead a quiet life. Not to cause problems or disruptions or force your way on others. That's not how we are to live. To mind your own business, he says. Not to try to control how others live. Stay in your lane, in other words. As Barnes says, to attend to their own concerns without interfering with the fear or the affairs of others. And the third thing he mentioned was work with your own hands, simply to avoid the issues of idleness. This is a problem, probably, at the Thessalonians that he needed to address there with idleness. Now we're going to move into a section talking about the first resurrection and the concerns surrounding those who have already died. We again turn to this passage around trumpets and we go through those. Although that is the concentration of the passage, we're not going to look too deeply at all of that, but rather what we are to do with it. What are we to do with the understanding that we have? What are we to do with what God has given us? Let's continue. Verse 13 says, but I do not want you to be ignorant, brethren, concerning those who have fallen asleep, lest you sorrow as others who have no hope. They had loved ones that they were worried about, but they didn't know what would happen. Those who have already fallen asleep, those who have already died, what happens to them? Verse 14, for if we believe that Jesus died and rose again, even so God will bring with him those who sleep in Jesus. Those would have been incredible words. Why? Because every single person in there had somebody in mind. They had a face in mind that was fitting to what was being said. They could put a face of what he was relating to. Verse 15, for this we say to you by the word of the Lord, that we who are alive and remain until the coming of the Lord will by no means precede those who are asleep. They're not going to be left behind. They're not going to be left at all. Verse 16, for the Lord himself will descend from heaven with a shout, with the voice of an archangel, and with the trumpet of God. It gives the time frame. And the dead in Christ will rise first. Then we who are alive and remain shall be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air. And thus we shall always be with the Lord. So we have this great passage being explained. There's something that means so much to the people hearing it, as this would have been read out loud, but it doesn't end there. It's an encouraging passage already, but Paul gives all of us the responsibility with what we do with what we know and understand. He said, there's something that falls on your shoulders, my shoulders. Verse 18, therefore, comfort, encourage one another with these words. Are we to comfort one another with these words once or twice? Is that what he's talking about? Or are we to talk about this and encourage one another with this ongoing? Because what we have is gold. What we understand is an amazing treasure. And he's saying, talk about it. Encourage one another with it. Not just this message, but the whole gospel. And how is this best administered? Together. Is best administered together in support and comfort of each other. One last passage. Paul gives another example in Colossians. Go to Colossians 1. Colossians 1. God's truth must never become old for us. It's an amazing truth. We had a small gathering together, and we were talking about just that last night, of God's truth can never be something that we're bored with. Many of us grew up in the church and have always heard it, but it can't be something that it's always just something that we've heard. It has to live within us and be exciting always, because it never stops being an amazing treasure. You know, not looking for something else or something new. It's looking within what God has given us, an amazing message. For Colossians, I can get off a little bit on topic. Colossians 1, verse 9 said, "For this reason, we also, since the day we heard it," well, heard what? Let's back up a little bit to verse 8. "Who also declared to us your love in the Spirit." They had this in abundance. Now verse 9. "For this reason, we also, since the day we heard it, do not cease to pray for you and ask that you may be filled with the knowledge of his will in all wisdom and spiritual understanding." Why? To hoard it and keep it within you, or to share it? Absolutely to share it. Verse 10. "That you may walk worthy of the Lord, fully pleasing him, being fruitful in every good work and increasing in the knowledge of God, strengthened with all might according to his glorious power, for all patience and long-suffering with joy, giving thanks to the Father who has qualified us to be partakers of the inheritance of the saints in the light." Paul is again giving an encouraging message. You do a little bit of a study of just those few verses, that's pretty amazing what he has given us. It is by the words to motivate them to walk worthy of the Lord. He talks about the inheritance and how we are qualified. He is putting them, he's saying, you are qualified for what I'm talking about here. He's placing them, men, women, it didn't matter. He's placing them within that. But in verse 9, he does something that they would have felt the support from Timothy and Paul. In verse 1, talks about how Timothy is there. This is a message from Timothy and Paul. Both of them are there. He says, in verse 9, "For this reason, we also, since the day we heard it," we, Timothy and Paul, "heard it, do not cease to pray for you." They knew that they were being thought about, prayed about, concerned for, and loved. It's an incredible thing to hear from people. I know we do it. I mean, you look at the back room, the back table, it's filled with cards. We think about people, we pray for them. To have someone come to you in a situation of your life, and I could say, I'm guessing, I don't know all the stories of your life, I don't know all the stuff that has happened to you, I would love to get to know everyone more and more and more, and I don't know all the stories, but I'm pretty safe to say you've had trials. We all have trials. We all go through things. But to have someone come to you in a situation of your life and say, I've been praying for you, I've been thinking about you, you've been on my mind, is an incredible thing. To have somebody say, it's an incredibly powerful thing. It's an incredibly encouraging thing to know that you are not alone. That's one way that we say, yeah, you're not alone. Yeah, you have the greatest power on earth with you, absolutely. You have God's Spirit, you have God, but you also have us. You also have us, your brothers and sisters. Thing is, we need one another. In closing, as Barnabas means son of encouragement, wouldn't it be great if that was our title? It was something that was given to us as well, as sons or children of encouragement. That is such a part of us that that's what we were known by. Well, we can certainly grow in this quality. We can grow in it by the words that we speak. These are simple things, but they're profound. They're big. By the words that we speak, but also the support that we give. As I've said before, I've given sermons on different qualities, different things that we need to grow as Christians. And I believe this quality, among other ones, become more and more important as time goes on, because the darker the world gets, the brighter we are to get. How do we do that? We do that together. Let us grow and develop in this quality of encouragement to help each other grow in strength, to help each other grow in courage as we progress forward as a more unified congregation and family.